Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Business and Labor Committee to order. We will be carrying over Senate Bill 297A, Senate Bill 488A, Senate Bill 583A, Senate Bill 699, and Senate Bill 879A, to mention a few.
We should have started it at 9:30.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I couldn't resist.
With that, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 380A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure grants the Labor Commissioner discretion over the preparation of formal charges in some instances. Declares an emergency. There are no amendments before you. The Senate vote was 30-0.
Great. So let's have Paloma Sparks, Peggy McGuire, and Sybil Hebb, please. Good morning. Thank you for being here on time this morning. Paloma, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and get us started.
Good morning, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. As you know, the Bureau enforces anti-discrimination laws in employment, public accommodation, and housing. Current state law requires that when we have a housing complaint, if any party elects to take their case to court outside of the bureau, the BOLI venue, we must have DOJ represent them in addition to if they have private counsel. That is the current law. It is costing us quite a bit of money. It's estimated that we will incur about $20,000 a month in legal costs. So we're trying to change the law to give us some discretion that there may be circumstances under which it is not appropriate to for the Bureau to represent those individuals in court. As you know, legal costs can rack up quite quickly. A single case can incur $100,000 in legal costs. We've had cases where the Bureau did not recover any of that money, and recently we had to start paying those costs. And none of those cases have gone to trial yet. So where a case goes to trial, that could really bump up those costs, and we think that it is appropriate. The agency is dedicated to prosecuting anti-discrimination laws in housing. We absolutely believe that this is a core function of what the agency does, but current structure is unsustainable. And if we continue at this rate, we're going to have to cut back on the crucial enforcement that we do in all other areas of civil rights protections.
Thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Representative Holvey, Chair Holvey, and members of the committee. I'm Peggy McGuire. I'm the Executive Director of the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. We're a statewide nonprofit agency, and we help eliminate illegal discrimination in Oregon. Every year, we get about 3,000 people who contact us in our statewide toll-free hotline and tell us something happened in their housing transaction, and they believe it might be discriminatory, and so we help them figure out if that was the case or not. We refer cases that meet all of the elements of a bona fide fair housing claim to our colleagues at BOLI to investigate. And there's probably about 100 cases a year that we believe BOLI is investigating. Many years ago, probably about 10 years ago, we began working with BOLI to change our Oregon laws to ensure that they were substantially equivalent with the federal laws so that BOLI could receive payments from HUD to investigate on their behalf. So they have that contractual arrangement with HUD. I'm concerned that if with this change, that substantial equivalency will be out of compliance and HUD will no longer contract with BOLI. It seems like such a small change, but the requirement is to ensure that people who would not otherwise be represented have representation if someone elects to go to court. So, for example, if a landlord has had a substantial evidence determination found that it appears they've been discriminating, they can elect to go to court, and if there's no one to represent the tenant, then the landlord will win the case. And so taking that opportunity to have BOLI represent those folks in court away will create a definitely uneven playing field. And again, as I mentioned, my grants and contracts, which our agency is funded primarily through grants and contracts, require that we move forward with these cases as a piece of getting the funding. And if we can't take the cases to BOLI because they're substantially equivalent, we'll be forced to have HUD investigate the cases. And I'll just tell you, BOLI is a fantastic agency. They do a great job, very thorough investigations, very expeditious investigations. And we find that our cases languish in HUD for years on end, which in the reality, when many landlords are represented by attorneys, this is racking up hundreds of thousands of dollars for attorneys. Of attorney's fees for landlords in that process, and our clients typically don't have anyone to represent them. So, like I say, it seems like it's a seemingly small change, represent these people, but it's a huge impact.
Thank you.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today to share our perspective. We've registered as neutral on the bills. We do not oppose it. I want to register a couple of things for the record. We understand that BOLI, and agree with Ms. McGuire's comments, that they play a fundamental role in that the investigation and prosecution of fair housing violations is a hugely important role for the agency. It's a hugely important role for our clients. And to us, it's a great benefit that happens here in Oregon, as opposed to being residing with HUD up in Seattle, where we agree cases languish. We understand and don't dispute the dilemma that the agency is in with respect to their budget. We're distressed about the situation and about what the possible ramifications might be of this change that they propose. And so just to go back and make sure to clarify, the current law right now has a mandate that BOLI represent when a plaintiff elects to go to court. And we understand that puts the agency in a dilemma in some circumstances. But that language is mandated was mandated back in 2008, I believe it was, or 2009, when we, with many other stakeholders, including the agency and many other partners, changed the statutes to make sure that they were substantially equivalent as determined by HUD with federal fair housing, so that HUD would give BOLI the contract to do local enforcement of these cases. Excuse me, I got something caught in my throat. And so our concern is that by changing that language, we may run the risk of falling out of substantial equivalency with the federal law and therefore losing the contract with the feds to do local enforcement. And we're concerned about what the ramifications might be if that happens. I think the agency has indicated that they are not sure that will happen, and that the feds may not remove that contract, and that the state will continue to be able to have those cases reside here in Oregon. If that's true, then that's positive. If we do lose the contract and the cases do end up having to go to the Seattle office of HUD for handling, we think that's a great detriment to the state of Oregon and to citizens, and we would certainly, so we're here basically to put that concern on the record, so that if that does happen and that is the outcome, and we are back to ask for help and essentially financial assistance for the agency to be able to maintain that contract here, it won't be a surprise to you all. So I guess those are the concerns we wanted to flag for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm so sorry, Chair. I just remembered there was something really important that I wanted to clarify. I apologize. I think none of us has mentioned thus far that the only cases in which the agency is obligated under the current law to go to court is are cases in which there has already been a finding by the agency that there has been a substantial violation of the fair housing laws. So these are not, the agency may at some point along the line have a difference of opinion from the plaintiff as to how much that case is worth or what they want to do with that, but these are cases that are, according to the agency's determination, violations of the fair housing laws. So, sorry. Just wanted to clarify that.
So just real quick, a quick clarification. So BOLI is required to represent claimants when they want to take something to court. And does that apply even if the claimant has other representation, legal representation?
Chair Holvey, that's correct. BOLI is required to represent them even if they have counsel.
And is that part of the substantial equivalency as well? is it regardless of whether a claimant has other representation or the ability to pay for other representation?
Chair Holvey, yes, that's correct.
If I could add, Chair Holvey and members of the committee, the BOLI represents the case, and so that's not the individual's particular perspective. So help me here, attorney, that a person may wish to, they may be asking for damages, and BOLI doesn't necessarily have to ask for those damages.
If I may, Chair Holvey and committee, I think a good comparison here, BOLI essentially plays the role of the state prosecutor in this case. And so as we all, I think in the context of criminal cases, for example, I think we understand that the prosecutor represents the interests of the state. Sometimes those are aligned with the victim in the case, and sometimes there are different interests. Doesn't mean that those interests are opposed necessarily, but they have different. There are different interests, and so I think it's kind of the same analogy in this case. And the substantial equivalency language requires the state to move forward with those cases where there are findings of good cause, and the plaintiff wants to remove to go to court, even if the agency might have made a different call about whether or not it should go to court.
Or the respondent may wish to go.
I'm sorry, correct. Also if the respondent.
Thank you, and I understand that the increased cost to BOLI is largely due to the Department of Justice charges for the attorneys representing BOLI in the court process.
Chair Holvey, that's correct. If we have to go to court, DOJ represents the agency.
And in previous years, this wasn't an issue because Department of Justice did not charge BOLI for that representation. Is that what I'm understanding?
Chair Holvey, that's correct. They were absorbing some of the costs. Costs have been increasing, and they no longer feel comfortable absorbing that kind of cost.
So for the committee's information, I'm not intending on moving this bill today. I still am trying to talk to the Ways and Means process to see if there's any potential relief in this situation. It is a little bit of a dilemma on how to proceed with this, recognizing the importance of BOLI representing these cases as opposed to HUD, but also recognizing we can't be laying off investigators for discrimination because of these costs and the inadequate reimbursement from the federal government, I assume, for this contract. So I'll open up to a couple questions. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Really, start as a question, that will be a comment. You know, usually at this point in the legislative process, we're in the final week. The bills that are in front of us that are just getting hearings are either already fully baked and pretty well sorted out and we can pass it quite easily, or fatally flawed, because that's why they're still around. This seems odd in that it's neither. It seems to me that, and I could be, maybe there's something I'm missing here, but it does seem like the opponents are raising legitimate concern about federal compliance. Meanwhile, it seems to me that the agency has a fair point about dual representation and how that might be redundant in time to time. Is there not a middle ground here? It seems to, I could be wrong, but why couldn't the parties get together and have kind of sorted this out in a way that's mutually acceptable? Why hasn't that happened at the last, here we are in June?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barton, the Bureau believes, and we have seen other states have similar flexibility. They have not lost their contracts with HUD. Additionally, current statute says that we have to do this. So even in most, say, employment discrimination cases, we would not be representing when somebody elects to leave our venue. That's their choice, but the Bureau wouldn't be following them. I understand the concerns of the housing advocates about what happens if the HUD contract goes away. I would just say that, you know, tenants could still file a complaint with BOLI. We can enforce under state law, even if that happened.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
So very often when we have kind of ambiguous federal regulations, i.e. are we going to comply with it or not, we often will rely on some authority, for example, an advisory letter from the federal agency or something of that sort. Even though it's not legally binding, it's something we often consider it a safe harbor, i.e. if we comply with that. Is there any authority or anything that's coming from HUD, even statements, anything that suggests? The experience of other states is one source of authority, I guess, but is there anything else?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barton, HUD is not the best at communicating.
Other questions, Julian, comments?
Julian Castro.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Squire, did you testify similarly in the Senate?
Chair Holvey and Vice Chair Kinnemer, yes, I did. And I would also like to just quickly comment that I've actually spoken directly with HUD, the folks who are in control of the BOLI contract, and they've indicated that they've formally notified BOLI that this will put them substantially out of, or put them out of substantial equivalency if this bill passes.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you. I would just also add, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, I would add that I appreciate the question about whether or not there's a middle ground, and I think the problem is that because the concern we have is about whether or not we're substantially equivalent, and if we're not, that is what results in the risk of potentially losing the contract. So we don't have a lot of middle ability to come to compromise with the federal government. You know, there's the language either matches or it doesn't, and so a change, if we're told that it brings us out of substantial equivalency, is what results in the risk. I think the way to address that without changing the law and without risking substantial equivalency is to fund the expense of the prosecutions, and unfortunately, I think we got into this discussion or learned of this issue too late, kind of in the process, to fully have had the chance to address that through the Ways and Means process. So I think that's kind of where we are. We don't dispute that there are expenses and that they're not part of the current agency's budget. So,
Chair Holvey, I have my Civil Rights Division Administrator here also, if you would like to hear from her about our interactions with HUD on this issue.
I'd like to. No, I don't want to.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Clare. I'm the Administrator of the Civil Rights Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Hopefully I can answer some questions. I would like to point out that although HUD has informed us that they would view us as being out of substantial equivalency, they did not outright tell us that they would pull our contract. The reality is a number of states and a number of local municipalities are not substantially equivalent. HUD acknowledges that. They haven't pulled all their contracts. It's a conversation that needs to happen. What happens with states that aren't wanting to incur those costs is they reverse their findings if they don't go cause. We have a high cause rate. And because we have a high cause rate, we don't think we should cut back down on when we find evidence of unlawful discrimination. We don't think we should reverse those findings to avoid the court costs. But in an employment type of case, if they decide to stay in our forum, they go through our prosecution unit. We have case presenters that will represent the complainants and the interests of the state. But the reality is at nearly 100%, about 99% of the cases where we've gone cause on housing cases, they've elected. I believe that Fair Housing Council was involved about 16 of those, and their right respondents can also elect. The estimate is from Department of Justice. They started charging us in September of 2014. Is $20,000 per month. We had 1 month that was nearly $40,000 in bills. My budget for the biennium for this last that ends in June, that ended in June, well, will end in June, was $37,000 for the entire biennium, which we don't have the money to litigate those cases. So we really are in a true dilemma. We are looking at layoffs if we if this passes and HUD pulls our contract.
Can you rephrase that? You say you are looking at layoffs if this bill passes or does not pass.
If this bill does not pass, if I misspoke, I apologize. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you. Ms. Clare, it's nice. I like how you thought that you were going to get away without coming up to talk. Nice try, by the way. So when you say HUD communicated regarding whether or not how this bill will affect special compliance, how did they do so? Is it in writing? And if so, can you share that with us?
I can go back and look at emails. To be real candid with you, Chair Hovey, Representative Barton, they're very sensitive about this. And there's been a change in administration. And when we first were trying to get substantial equivalency, and I really have to give Peggy McGuire credit for that. I was new at Boley at that time. Like in 2003, I knew nothing about any of this. She met with me and said, this is something that Boley should be doing. And it took five legislative sessions and one February session to finally get us through substantial equivalency. So we were pretty new at it. HUD, in the beginning, they have an Office of Legal Counsel that sometimes is communicative and sometimes not. They would just say, we don't believe that you're substantial equivalent. You need to change this. You need to change the rule. They finally deemed us substantial equivalent in an interim capacity in April of 2008. And then, you know, later that year, we had a new administration come in, and so some of their perspectives were different. We were still new to doing investigations, so we hadn't gone through several findings of substantial evidence where we were starting to get a lot of cases that were being litigated. So we just had a handful in, like, around 2010. The former attorney general did have a special civil rights unit that was generally funded, so they were doing the litigation on our behalf, but there weren't that many cases. And then going forward a few more years, we have a different attorney general, and we had up to 20 cases now that had elected, and several attorneys working for us. And they said they told us, Department of Justice, that they can't sustain this. And they weren't sure when they were going to start billing us, but then they informed us they were to start billing us. We've been informing HUD all along, and I can provide you with the correspondence we sent them along with our DOJ bill saying, please help us, please help fund the litigation. We're not sure what to do here. We don't think we should reverse our cause findings like we know Washington State did in 20 cases that were with their Department of Justice. To us, that's unconscionable. But I would like to say not every case is litigation worthy. We have cases where if there's been a testing or just even an individual complainant that maybe the landlord said we don't allow pets, and maybe they don't understand that companion animals and service animals have to be allowed. They're not viewed as pets. You can't charge deposits. Some of them are saying, I didn't realize that was the law. They're willing to take training. We think that would be a good resolution to the case, to monitor them. And not have it be litigated in our prosecution unit or with the Department of Justice, but we don't have that discretion at this time.
Thank you. And again, committee, this bill will come back to us, I think, later in the week. Is there any other questions right at the moment, Representative Barreto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just want to know which other states have gone this route.
Chair Hovey, Representative Barreto, the one that is most analogous to ours is Arkansas, and I can get that for you. We did some research. They, I believe it was in 2010, changed their language in their state law to allow this discretion. I did call HUD headquarters and speak with their guru on this, and he was, you know, outraged and upset, and he said, well, I'm going to follow up with that. To my knowledge, at this point, they are still viewed as substantially equivalent, and they're putting on fair housing and having HUD representatives speaking at their events, so I don't think they've lost their substantial equivalency. But the concern is real. I don't want to dispute that.
Thank you. So if HUD were to take this contract or discontinue this contract, would they be obligated, the same as the state is, to represent these cases? So I'm guessing they probably couldn't represent it any cheaper than Bowley could.
Well, Representative Holvey, Chair Holvey, it's the part that's a little bit ironic is when HUD goes cause, when they rarely do go cause, if someone does elect to go, the U.S. Department of Justice litigates, and HUD does not have to pay the U.S. Department of Justice to litigate those cases.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I appreciate your testimony. I know it's a perplexing issue, and we'll come back to it later in the week.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 380. As I mentioned, we will mark this one for carrying over. We're not working Senate Bill 470. I didn't mention that at the outset. Issue will become a work group, which we don't need legislation for. With that, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 137A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, remind you of this bill. This is the bill that was heard May 18th. It modifies the public works definition for the purpose of applying prevailing wage to include projects that use at least $750,000 of public funds for the construction, reconstruction, painting, or major renovation on a publicly or privately owned road, highway, building, structure, or improvement. It becomes operative January 1, 2016. There's a declaration of emergency, and there are no amendments. The Senate vote was 22-6. There's no revenue, and there's a minimal fiscal impact.
Chair Holvey, I move Senate Bill 137A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Barton moves Senate Bill 137A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wagner.
Well, if you know on this, I would like to have actually seen us adjust this up to $1 million above $750,000. Just with inflation and everything that's going on, if we're putting number to it, we need to consider the cost of goods and everything else going up. So I will be a no.
Granted. Appreciate that. I was contemplating moving it down to $50,000, but so we're somewhere in the middle here.
Don't go there, Mr. Chair. We struggle too much with this, Mr. Chair. Don't go there.
I just said it was a wish.
See.
Any other conversations? Matthew, can we have a roll call, please?
Representative Beretta?
No.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Basketball?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative
Byrd?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cameron?
Aye.
Chair Holvey?
Aye. Senate Bill 137A, having received the votes, is passed to the floor. And I'll carry this one. Close the work session on Senate Bill 137A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 462A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the committee heard this on May 6th. It's the measure that changes provisions of secured transactions section of the Uniform Commercial Code. Provides that the record is effective as a financing statement if the record satisfies the requirement for financing statement and sufficiently provides the name of the debtor. And it requires a financing statement to show the name of the individual debtor as indicated on an unexpired driver's license or identification card for sufficiency of name on the financing statement. And it provides a phase-in period. Declares an emergency. There's no amendment. Senate vote was 28-0. There's no revenue and there's no fiscal impact.
Chair Holvey, I move Senate Bill 462A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 462A to the floor of the two-pass recommendation. Discussion. I will say this was a difficult bill, but I appreciate everybody weighing in, and mean no disrespect to the state law commission and who had a differing opinion on this bill, but I think we'll keep an eye on this one as it gets implemented. Matthew, can we have a roll call, please?
Representative Breda?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esco?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Wyden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gordon?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenmer?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 462A, having received the votes, is passed. Volunteer to carry the bill?
No. Got it.
I'll carry it.
Representative Kenmer, thank you.
That was difficult for you. I was explaining it.
We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 462A and open a work session on Senate Bill 578.
Committee members, the committee heard this on April 27th. It's the measure that permits an insurer under certain conditions to post the policy, the insurance policy and endorsements on the insurer's website instead of mailing or delivering the policy to the insured. The proposed Dash 1 amendment that came up after the committee hearing corrects or provides an exemption from the consent and notice requirements that are required under Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. The Senate vote on this measure was 29-1. There's no revenue impact, and there's no fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, did you say 68 or 78?
This is 578.
Yes. I thought I heard you say 68.
No, you did not.
I did 578.
Okay. Mr. Chair, or Jan, with your permission, did we hear the Dash 1 before this? Or is this the first we're hearing about the Dash 1?
No, this is the first you're hearing about it. After the public hearing, the insurance division pointed out that there is probably a conflict with the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act, which requires the consent, the written consent of consumers anytime that there is a replacement of a written statement with an electronic transaction. So this is exempting the posting of these policies on a website from the UETA.
Chair Hovey, I move the Dash 1 amendment into Senate Bill 578.
Representative Barton moves the Dash 1 amendment into Senate Bill 578. I don't believe DCBS, the insurance division, is in the room.
She's in Senate Judiciary.
Okay. Is there any discussion on the Dash 1 amendment? Everybody's comfortable. Is there any objection to adopting the Dash 1 amendment? Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendment's adopted.
I'm comfortable. Chair Holdy, I move Senate Bill 578 as amended to the floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 578 as amended to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, Matthew, can we have a roll call, please?
Representative Breda?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esco?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Wyden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Evans?
Aye.
Chair Holden?
Aye. Senate Bill 578 having received the votes is passed. Carrier? Representative Barreto, thank you. That I'm gonna open a did I close the work session?
I don't remember hearing that.
I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 578 and open a work session on Senate Bill 715.
Uh, Mr. Chair and committee members, committee heard this April 27th. The bill permits licensed insurance providers to be the licensees for products that are distributed through non-insurance travel retailers if specific conditions protecting consumers are met, including the registration of the agents, training, and consumer disclosures. Declares an emergency. There's a proposed Dash 1 amendment that changes the operative date to July 1 of 2016 instead of the January 1, 2016 that's in the bill. The amendment came up after the committee heard the bill, and it was at the request of the Insurance Division to provide a little extra time for their rulemaking. The Senate vote on this measure was 30-0. There's no revenue impact, and there's no fiscal impact.
Chair Holvey, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 715.
Representative Barton moves Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 715. Discussion. Is there any objection to adopting the Dash 1 amendments? Seeing none, Dash 1s are adopted.
Chair Holvey, I move Senate Bill 715 as amended to the floor at the due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 715 to the as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, Matthew, can we have a roll call, please?
Representative Beretta?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Mescal?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative
Nose? Aye.
Representative Weiner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bowman?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Kinnemer?
Aye.
Chair
Holby? Aye. Senate Bill 715, having received the votes, is passed. Carriers, Representative Esquivel, thank you. We're going to stand at ease.
At ease.
Jeez. Impressive. So, I'd like to reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor. We will be carrying over Senate Bill 380A. We will be carrying over Senate Bill 297A. We will be carrying over Senate Bill 488A. We will be carrying over Senate Bill 580A. Carrying over Senate Bill 583A. Carrying over Senate Bill 699. Carrying over Senate Bill 879A. Carrying over Senate Bill 934A.
Pretty well taken care of.
Oh, yeah, 380. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. With that, committee, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.
Okay. We're meeting Wednesday at 8.
Okay.
We're meeting Wednesday at 8.